Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic. Yeah. It's atomic.
Ron, how you doing?
Good, Andrew. How are you?
I'm great. We on? We live?
Yes, we are on. I'm recording. What I'll do is I'll go ahead and introduce us and the show, and then we can go from there.
All right, sounds good to me.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 89. And today I have with me a guest. His name is Andrew Feinberg, and he is one of two of the bloggers behind Capital Valley, whose tagline is 27 hours of technology and politics, I believe. And Andrew and I got into a little bit of a discussion. A couple of weeks ago, Andrew interviewed Patrick Moore and had a great interview. Patrick talked about his involvement with Greenpeace and his shift of moving from against nuclear power to for nuclear power. And one of the comments that Patrick made during that interview was something about the grand plan for liquefied natural gas being the electricity supply for the United States. I listened to that and wrote a letter to Andrew, and he took issue with some of my interpretation, so we got into a little discussion. So I think Andrew and I have some things to talk about and perhaps can share our view of the world through somewhat different lenses. Andrew, why don't you tell the listener something about yourself and what you do?
Well, I do as little as possible. No, I'm kidding. I am. My day job, I can't really talk about. The rest of my time, which is most of my time, is taken up by writing and editing for Capital Valley, and we are right now, it's a two-person partnership between myself and Alex Drakowski, who's another writer based out in San Francisco Bay Area, and what we try to do is cover what we like to call the cloud of technology and public policy. There's a lot of different intersections and places where the two come together, and sometimes in good ways, sometimes in bad ways, and sometimes government can hinder technology, sometimes government can spur great things, and we like to talk about that. We talk about regulation, we talk about the FCC a lot. My background is a little unique. I was a Debian Linux developer back in the late 90s, and this was when I was in high school. I'm only about 25 years old. And then I got out to college in Madison, Wisconsin, and sat down for my first few computer science classes and realized this was probably a bad idea. So what I ended up studying was the history of technology. So I write about code, but I generally don't write code. So that's me. And the interview with Dr. Moore was sort of a surprise thing. They called me up and Alex up and asked if we wanted to get together, and being that I was the one on the East Coast, I got the honor of doing it. And Dr. Moore is a pretty fascinating guy. He doesn't miss much, and he's pretty introspective, especially when you look at his personal history and the history of the anti-nuclear movement and its relationship to what's now the movement against climate change and for energy security.
Yeah, I find that quite fascinating myself because as a former submarine engineer officer, when people are excited about the impacts of global climate change and yet want to take nuclear off the table, I get very confused by their understanding of the world, since I used to be able to operate my power plant inside a sealed ship.
Well, I mean, you also used to, I mean, you lived in one for, well, not in one, I'd hope, but you lived in very close proximity to a nuclear reactor for, I'm guessing, a few good years of your life, and I mean, everything seems to have turned out okay. I think, and what Dr. Moore said early in the interview was that Greenpeace came out of a movement to stop nuclear weapons testing. And somewhere along the way, nuclear weapons and nuclear energy became linked. Mm-hmm. And that PR marriage served the environmental movement very well, but it didn't do a very good job for the nuclear industry. And what happened was they couldn't ban it outright, but they did make it pretty well near impossible to build a nuclear plant. And in fact, right now there are 7 applications pending to build new reactors. It's the first applications in 30 years. I live up the street from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission in Rockville, Maryland, and, you know, sign of times, they just expanded into another building. There are 2 towers. If you drive up Rockville Pike, you know where, right, of course, the Naval Hospital is.
Yeah, I've been
Hope not for anything bad.
No.
Beautiful building, though.
I've also been to the NRC a few times.
Oh, okay. All right. NRC is not as good looking as the tower of the hospital, but in its own way. You know, you're up and you have these 2 towers, and one of them, I don't know what it was, but suddenly, maybe a year ago, both towers were occupied by the NRC. And shortly after, figured out, oh, they're processing the applications, and it, from news accounts, it was actually a problem because a lot of the people who remembered how to process them were either retired or dead. So they're sort of in the process of relearning a lot of that stuff, I guess. I
mean, yeah, they're definitely a growth industry. They are hiring about, trying to get 200 to 300 net new employees each year for the last 2 years, and looking to keep that up for another 5 years.
So that would be good. I mean, more, I find it, you know, even so, I find it really almost troubling that they need that large regulatory framework. Then again, I understand, and you would know better than I, that the tolerances and the operating standards for naval reactors are incredibly strict.
Yeah,
and I'm guessing.
But they are, but we don't need, we don't use anywhere near the kind of infrastructure that the NRC uses, because we have in the Navy built classes of reactors where, you know, we will build, in one case we built about 70 or 80 that were all exactly the same.
Right, and no, I'm guessing then the civilian reactors, that they're not all the same.
Well, the first generation were not. The next generation, it looks like there's going to be several classes. There's probably about 4 different reactors that are already announced and will be used for the next generation, and there are several more that are being designed. But the NRC's guidance is to try to put together design teams. You know, everybody who wants to build an EPR, that's the Areva design, will work together, and everybody who wants to build a Westinghouse AP1000 will work together and agree to keep them all the same, and for, you know, that's going on. But going back to one of the things that I've, one of the reasons I wanted to invite you on is that, and we talked a little bit earlier today, you made a comment that I like to resist. When people who are interested in technology classify nuclear as an old technology, because nuclear is a very new technology on the scheme of the energy business. Matter of fact, it's the only new energy source that's been found or discovered within the last several hundred years.
I think that's an interesting point on a macro level of looking at time. Yeah, it doesn't involve burning anything.
Right. And, I mean, in comparison to, say, computers, the basic discoveries that make all of our computers function today, many of those basic discoveries were well known before fission was ever known or understood. You know, things like, you know, semiconductors and that kind of stuff date back before the actual discovery of self-sustaining fission. So nuclear technology is very new, and what we're using today, what's generating 20% of our electricity, is technology that was implemented in the 1950s and 60s. And one of the things that's always interesting is that people want to talk about nuclear in those terms, the stuff that we have today from the 50s and 60s, yet they want to talk about some sort of magical future technology where energy storage is cheap, where the wind blows all the time, where you can, you know, produce very efficient solar cells for free. And, you know, they don't want to, you know, acknowledge that nuclear technology has come a long way since the 50s and 60s, and that the new generation is something to be excited about.
Oh, I disagree with you there. When I refer to nuclear technology, an old technology, and of course the title of my article was Everything Old is New Again, what I meant to say, and I think what a lot of people mean, is you have a nuclear reactor, and when people think of nuclear power, of course, you know, the first controlled nuclear fission dates back to the 40s and 50s, and the Trinity test, and...
Well, Trinity, you know, wasn't exactly controlled. The first controlled reaction was December 2nd, 1942, underneath
you would know better than I.
Underneath the squash courts in Chicago.
Right, right. I thought it was the football stadium for some reason, but I'm going to defer to you on that.
I should
that.
Say in the squash courts, which were underneath the football stadium. So we're both right.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, I guess that's proof that the University of Chicago didn't have a very good squash team, or University of Illinois.
Well, they didn't have much of a football team, that's for sure.
Well, they still don't, thank God. I went to Wisconsin, so I'm a little partisan.
Okay.
But anyway, when we say old, I think the reason that we mean old is that the idea of smashing atoms, controlling the reaction, generating heat, heating water to power a steam turbine is not a new idea. It's not, you know, within the past few years, been a light bulb in someone's head. We could use nuclear energy. I mean, the U.S. Navy and others, you know, others, the Russian Navy, although with a less fantastic safety record, and I know the British and other countries have operated nuclear boats for many, many years, and people have lived in close proximity to those reactors. And when I say old, I mean it's not in the experimental phase. It's not something that, oh, we need to look at it more. We need to study it more. We know this stuff's safe when done properly. You lived in a metal tube surrounding a nuclear reactor for weeks and months at a time. And I haven't met you in person, but I assume that you don't glow in the dark.
Oh, I only glow when I'm talking about nuclear technologies. I shine at that point. But.
Okay, well, shining and glowing are two different things. I guess, but what I'm saying is, this is something that we've known about that has been known to be safe when done right. Go ahead.
Well, but what we haven't necessarily done is to do what we've done with other technologies, which is, okay, we know how to do this safely. How can we apply this to a larger and larger set of applications? How can we refine it so that it can be operated by people who are less specialized? I mean, if you look at the technology path of the automobile industry, the computer industry, cellular telephones, the path is always the early adopters, the people who really need the technology or can really afford to spend a lot on it, get it, get excited about it, and then work to improve it to the point where everybody can benefit from it. But that hasn't yet happened with nuclear.
Well, I think that that's because, as Dr. Moore said, there was a link made in people's minds between nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. And even to this day, the link is maintained by certain people in the government who would say, you know, I'm not going to ask you, you know, to say anything about our current president or vice president. I know that would violate a few general orders.
Yeah, go ahead. Keep going. I'm going to ask you a question right after this.
Go ahead. Yeah, okay. That they're making only, you know, they say that, I'll give Iran as an example, only because Iran has the distinction of having lots and lots of oil. But they also would like to build nuclear reactors. And their president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, or as Maureen Dowd calls him, I'm a dinner jacket. I think he has the most fun name of any international leader. it's so fun to say. He says, you know, peaceful nuclear energy is our right. You know, we want peaceful nuclear energy. And then you have people like Dick Cheney, who, I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't want to sound like one, but this is a guy that made his fortunes in oil, as did our current president really didn't make his fortune in oil, but worked in oil. Mr. Cheney, Vice President Cheney, did spend a lot of time at Halliburton, an oil services company, and he says, well, they want to build weapons is what they want. And yeah, you can build weapons. You can have breeder reactors. But as Dr. Moore said, those same breeder reactors can be used to produce fuel that's recyclable and recyclable and recyclable and prevent actually the nuclear waste problems that have been thrown about as a reason to not use nuclear energy, that we can just keep throwing this stuff back in until A, it's useless, and B, a lot less dangerous. And for an oil producing country that depends on exporting this stuff to want to use a technology that would allow them to sell more of it and use less of it for themselves. I mean, to me, it makes a lot of economic sense. And I really can't wrap my head around why the government of a country like ours, which is so dependent on foreign oil, if we're not going to go the nuclear path, wouldn't be happy to sell oil-producing nations reactors and say, oh, go ahead. You can shut those oil-fired and gas-fired plants down. We'll help you run these nice reactors that we've designed and built, and why don't you give us a, let's make a deal here. They win, we win. It doesn't solve our fossil fuel problem. It doesn't solve our greenhouse gas problem, but economically, both sides benefit in some way.
Oh, yes.
I mean, you have
indicated that we are very congruent in most of our thinking, because I feel the same way. It is logical to me why a country that exports oil would want to build reactors, particularly if they are currently burning oil in electrical power generators. You know, in the U.S., we can't afford to burn oil in electric power generators. We don't use it for that purpose. We try to save oil for purposes like transportation, where it's very hard to use coal as an alternative.
Clean coal really, when you look at it, it's an oxymoron, no matter how you think about it.
Yes.
I mean, clean coal is like saying kosher bacon.
Well, and I guess a guy named Andrew Feinberg can say that, make that comparison.
Yeah.
But,
fair enough.
Now, one of the reasons that I wrote to you was, you mentioned that the link between nuclear weapons and nuclear power had been made. But I was an English major in college and taught to avoid the passive voice. So the question that I have had, and I've been struggling with for a long time, is who made that linkage and why did they make that linkage? What was the motivation behind that? Was it simply a misguided misunderstanding by a few people who got together in a basement in Canada and then, you know, had a successful trip, and all of a sudden they said, well, geez, our next thing is going to go against nuclear power? That's Greenpeace's story. But the other side of it is, at the time, now we're talking early 1970s here, when Greenpeace was formed and the anti-nuclear movement started really taking off with protests at the Clamshell Alliance, at the Seabrook plant, and a few other places. At that time, suddenly there was a large group of people that were organizing against this new electricity source at a time before there had been any accidents, and were making this strong linkage to nuclear weapons and fighting against nuclear power.
I went back in a little bit. I listened to Dr. Moore, to my audio of Dr. Moore a little bit, and I regret that I didn't listen to it very carefully, as I was trying to do a million other things today. I think if I remember what he said, the link was made. It was part by accident and part because people in Nebraska are not going to care about the environmental effects of a nuclear test in, Puerto Rico,
mm-hmm.
Off of Puerto Rico. They're not going to care. It's just, it's not their problem. They figure, all right, you know, save the whales, good for them, but how does that affect me? But when you get into the idea of they're building a nuclear reactor 50 miles away from your house or whatever, you get into, I mean, for lack of a better word, NIMBYism. I think, you know, not in my backyard. I think that's a, that was a big part of it, that link was made because it was the easiest way for people against nuclear weapons testing to get more people involved and more donors and more public attention. Because, like I said, the people that care about, you know, offshore testing are a small number compared to the people that are going to worry when they're told a select part of information about a nuclear power plant that could be built near their home. And so that link, I think, was a necessary thing to do from a public relations standpoint. And I think even Dr. Moore acknowledged that. I'd have to go through the tapes again, but I think he acknowledged that it was quite unfortunate that happened, but the link was made because it was necessary to make it a broader-based movement. If you were against nuclear weapons, you were against nuclear power, nuclear was danger. Mm-hmm. You know, the two were, you know, no nukes.
Right.
That included weapons, that included power plants, and I think the naive assumption was if we get rid of one, then we can get rid of the other, and all we have to do is just keep screaming loudly wherever atoms are smashed.
Right.
And I think, and I'll just say one more thing, I think that the short-sightedness of that was, you know, this was, I'm not familiar when peak oil theory came about. You know, I knew at one point, but I've forgotten that class. But,
in the 1950s.
It's the 1950s, yeah.
M. King Hubbert.
I'm going to defer to you on that.
Let's see. I've got the oil drum as one of my favorite links, so I could figure that out. But I think it's 1954, if I remember correctly.
Good. Okay. I'll defer to you on it. But I think that there was a, you know, no one ever thinks about unintended. It's law of unintended consequences.
1974.
Okay, that's okay. I thought it was a little bit. So really about the same time you had peak oil theory starting to trickle through the academic community, but you had this groundswell of no nukes. And what I don't think happened was these people who were good-hearted, good-intentioned people didn't hear what was coming out of the other side with the peak oil side, that, hey, this isn't, we're not going to be able to do this forever. And also, I don't think that global warming, or as Frank once likes to call it, climate change, was thought about. And I really think, the environmental movement started to move away from the nuclear fear was when the ozone hole was discovered and you had a movement to ban CFCs. And then that's where we started talking about other things. But for a while, that was the linchpin of keeping that group together.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me take a minute here to try to. One of the reasons that we've gotten involved in the conversation is that, as I wanted to suggest to you, I believe that there is a very strong motivation on the same theory as Sun Tzu's theory that says the enemy of my enemy is my friend, that Greenpeace did, in fact, expand very rapidly and become a very well-funded organization in a short period of time. I listened to Patrick Moore talk at a ANS meeting, American Nuclear Society student conference in Texas, just a few, well, probably about a month ago now. And he talked about how they moved from their founding in a basement in Canada in 1971. By 1979, they were an international organization that was receiving over $100 million a year in contributions. Now, I spent some time running a fairly successful nonprofit organization. I was the president of a large little league. We had 600 players, and we owned our own fields and had to raise about $150,000 a year to keep the fields maintained and whatnot. And I know how hard it is to get individual contributions to a nonprofit organization. My wife...
That's on a pre-steroid baseball budget.
My wife... Say again?
That's on a pre-steroid baseball budget.
No, this is Little League.
Yeah, I know. Okay. I'm just messing with you.
Yeah. Now, and my wife works as a nonprofit, so I understand how difficult it is to raise funds for nonprofits, and I'm very impressed that an organization can get to $100 million a year. And I don't have good data on exactly where those contributions come from. They're supposedly from foundations and individuals. But I do know there's an awful lot of foundations whose money comes directly from the oil industry. Some of the large, most well-known foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Pew Charitable Trusts, among others, come directly from oil money. And in my view of the world, and having read a very extensive history of the oil industry called The Prize by Daniel Yergin, and understanding the law of supply and demand, it seems to me logical that many individuals who are interested in selling oil, and maybe even some rich individuals from outside the United States in places like Saudi Arabia, Russia, Venezuela, etc., would see people fighting nuclear power, which was growing very rapidly in the 1970s, and say, we need to slow that puppy down. So I will give contributions to these organizations that are already fighting nuclear power so they can become more powerful and be more successful in slowing down our competition. And every time I mention that, people in the nuclear business who are mostly engineers and can't see the fact that man's inhumanity to man is something that has been around for a long time, and that competition often means going negative, they get very defensive of the oil industry and say, nah, they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't be that devious. And you responded to my suggestion by calling me a crackpot, at least suggesting that I might be a crackpot.
No. In my offense, I...
Well, that, and I didn't take offense at it. I'm just, this is a way to increase the conversation. So
yeah, I mean,
of
first
that?
Off, a little tongue in cheek, but I'm not gonna pull any punches here. Whenever I hear, you know, these overarching theories of
now be careful. You know, there's a difference between a conspiracy theory where somebody, you know, goes and says all these guys met in a dark room somewhere. And just a logical, hey, these guys are slowing down our competition. Do they need some help to slow down our competition?
And I understand what you're saying, and I'll let me go ahead and break that down and break down why I what set off a red flag for me with that. And you give two examples, the Pew Charitable Trust and the Rockefeller Foundation. And I'm just trying to pull up some IRS records here. And now, yes, we have the Pew Trusts were founded by the children of the Sun Oil Company founder Joseph Pew. This is in 1948 through 1979. Mm-hmm. The Rockefeller Foundation, I'm guessing, is slightly older. I don't have.
Yeah, it's Standard Oil is probably 1908,
right.
Something like 1920s, maybe,
right.
I don't know.
Yeah. And I think I can see how those connections can get justified. On the other hand, I'm trying to think of another word than conspiracy theory to use, because that's a weasel word, that's a loaded word. It implies a conspiracy. I don't know where the money for this $100 million came from. I wouldn't be surprised if some of it came from the Pew Foundation, from the Pew Trust, the Rockefeller Foundation. On the other hand, when you look at a lot of the history of these foundations, their point was to assuage the guilt of these men who had built fortunes on the backs of others. And I mean, a great example of that is Andrew Carnegie and all the things that bear his name. J.P. Morgan. I mean, you have a long history of people who made their money doing some things that history would not and does not view kindly, trying to write their legacy through these foundations. And in some ways they have, in some ways they haven't. Mm-hmm. But I don't, it's almost like I see what you're saying, and I don't want, you know, I'm not going to say, oh God, that's impossible. But I find it hard to believe that there was, I mean, yeah, people know where their money's coming from, but at the same time, these organizations have charters, you know, have legal documents that are, you know, that say what they're supposed to do with their money. And
sure, they're supporting environmental organizations. What's,
right.
That can't be a violation of their charter.
No, not at all.
So the question is, again, can people and do people operate deviously at times, particularly those involved in marketing, politics, and big business? And is there a motivation? Does the oil industry and the coal industry, and particularly the natural gas part of the oil industry, are they more profitable by slowing the development of nuclear power than they would be if nuclear power was allowed to flourish?
I think, I'm not an economist. Thank God, my brain would explode. But I would say yes and no. I'd say in the short term view.
But that's all businesses operate on, is a short term view.
Right. In the short term view, yes. Do I think that in the 1970s, these trusts were funding Greenpeace with the intention of specifically slowing down nuclear weapons, or not nuclear weapons, sorry, I'm sorry, nuclear energy. I find that not impossible to believe, but
now remember,
it would be the kind of...
I wasn't limiting I mentioned those foundations as possible sources. I'm not
okay.
limiting the
right.
the oil, coal, and natural gas interests to those, because individuals, Greenpeace does accept money from individuals. They specifically say they don't accept money directly from corporations, just like
right.
political campaigns don't accept money directly from corporations.
Well,
but if right, but if everybody on the board of directors or everybody who's employed in management gives an individual contribution, that's not a corporate contribution. Or even if a few people give individual contributions, that's not a corporate contribution.
But, oh, no, not at all.
It certainly has some relationship to the employment.
You're right. You're right about that. Where I think you and I part company on this is in politics. You know, there's, you know, you have the concept of an ask, and there may be donations coming in from one guy and another guy and another guy. But I don't think there's an ask, and I don't think that these large membership
organizations... I'm not familiar with that concept, ask.
The concept of an ask, you know, say you are Greenpeace and I am Joe Big Oil board member, and I walk in... And I say, I am looking at my future. I'm looking at, you know, looking at the news. I see all these things. I don't like everything that's going on here. I think that you guys are doing some good. I would like to give you a check for $1 million. And you as Greenpeace, or any other organization, I'm just saying Greenpeace for sake of argument, accepts it. You know, there's no, I don't think there's a quid pro quo. I don't think there's an ask and quid pro quo, sort of the same concept. There's no, I don't think there's an expectation on one end that action will be taken on another end. And I also would note that these same environmental organizations have been very vocal about the oil industry and protesting the oil industry.
Right. They protest all new developments in the oil industry. They rarely, if ever, go to an existing producing well or an existing producing tanker run that happens every day or every week or whatever and try to slow that down. But they
well,
do,
it's already
in
there.
Fact. Right. This is what I'm saying, that the established everyday damage, they do nothing about. But the new stuff, the stuff that represents competition to the established everyday damage, is what these groups have focused on.
Well, now... Let's take that line for a second. I'll bite on that. In warfare,
mm-hmm.
This would be your expertise. Is it easier to defend a position or attack a position?
That depends.
Okay. Let me see if I can be more specific. I apologize.
No problem.
I'm trying to think on my feet here. Actually, I'm sitting down.
Maybe you should stand up.
No, the blood would rush to my head. That would be a problem. You know, entrenched, you have an entrenched position. You have a base. Say, we have an Air Force base in Germany. We have Ramstein Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. It's been there for a while.
Right.
And everyone knows where it is, and everyone's used to it being there. But as we did a few years ago, wanted to open up and use more facilities in Turkey,
mm-hmm,
to stage the invasion of Iraq.
Right.
And the Turkish government said, not going to happen.
Right.
In that case, it was easier for them to prevent something new than it would have been for the German government to say, whoa there, your base that you've had here since you liberated our country from the forces of evil.
Mm-hmm.
We appreciate all of that, and you know, thanks for keeping it here and the whole NATO thing. But we're not going to let you do that. We're not going to let you make your bombing runs or make your refueling runs out of Ramstein. I think that it's much easier to defeat something than it is, you know, that's in the planning stages and has not happened yet than it is to bring something down. The same
right.
is true in politics. It is always easier to kill a bill than it is to pass a bill.
And you're exactly right. And that's one of the things that I admire about Patrick Moore is that he has specifically stated on a number of occasions that one of the reasons that he is doing what he's doing today is, and why he left Greenpeace, was he got tired of fighting against new things, because he
right.
said it's always easier to stop something. And he said, what am I going to do to make the world a better place? I can't make it a better place simply by not doing anything. I have to go find what I want to be for rather than what I want to be against.
Absolutely.
But part of my thesis that does get me called a crackpot at times is that part of the reason that it is so much easier to fight against something that's new is that you do get assistance from all of the people that benefit from what exists already.
Well, of course.
Okay, so you are young
yeah.
enough not to know this, but in 1970, the Energy Information Administration predicted that by the year 2000, every electrical power plant in the United States would be nuclear powered. Now, if you're selling coal and you read that
okay.
prediction by your government, you're going to fight against that. And I'm not talking about from the viewpoint of the workers, because there's plenty of work in the nuclear industry, and the nuclear industry was growing very rapidly and produces some excellent jobs, and a lot of them, by the
right.
way.
Oh, yeah.
But if you
Absolutely.
Own coal capital, if your capital yeah. investment is mines, is coal cars for trains, is the enormous trucks, the mining equipment, all of those capital investments that you have borrowed a lot of money against, and that's where your wealth comes from. You're going to fight the idea that something new, that the government is supporting, by the way, with your tax dollars, is going to replace your business, is going to make you poor. You're going to fight it. And I'm not necessarily going to fight it openly.
Well, unless you're Robert Byrd. But yeah, I think that you're right. I think that there is today, the clean coal movement today is an astroturfing campaign by the coal industry. These energy bills that are moving through Congress right now, they keep trying to put in these subsidies for clean coal with capture and store.
Right, which is so far not technically possible.
No, it's not. It's pie in the sky. It's
it's a diversionary tactic.
It's like I said, clean coal is like kosher bacon. Capture and store you have the same problem that you have with what we used to call nuclear waste, because of course the Carter administration said you can't use recycled fuel. Now you can use recycled fuel. It's legal again, which is a good thing, because
it's actually been legal again since Ronald Reagan, but Ronald Reagan overturned Jimmy Carter's prohibition.
Shocking.
But the problem was that the industry that had invested before Carter's stroke of the pen put them out of business. They invested over $3 billion in recycling facilities. And Carter, by executive order, made those recycling facilities worthless. Now, if you're an investor and you realize that you're investing in something that one man can put out of business simply because he is poorly advised, you're probably not going to invest in that business again for a very long time until something dramatic changes.
Probably not. And I think I want to get back to what you said about coal earlier, the coal industry. I think you have a valid point that it is always easier to keep something going than it is to start something new. You know, in physics, we call it the law of inertia.
Mm-hmm.
But where I think that you and I part company is, and maybe I'm just young and naive, but I think
I've been accused of being old and cynical.
Fair. I've been accused of being young and cynical too. I hit for the cycle, but I think that the public policy issue, whether it's coal or nuclear, and something Dr. Moore was very adamant about, is a need for subsidies. All of these, we have this faith in the free market here that borders on insane. And something Dr. Moore was adamant about when we spoke was the government needs to subsidize nuclear energy.
Yeah,
it has to happen.
See, Dr. Moore and I disagree a little bit on that. My personal belief is that if the government would simply remove some of the enormous barriers to entry, and I'm not talking about the very fact of the regulation, I'm talking about the Reagan gift of the fees structure that is imposed upon. Right now, in order to get a new nuclear design licensed, the applicant has to pay the government $258 for every bureaucrat hour spent reviewing that application. And as you pointed out, there are now two buildings on Rockville Pike that are full of regulators who can bill against those hours. The last plant that got licensed cost the applicant over $100 million. Now, fortunately for that applicant, they happen to be politically connected enough to get grants from the DOE to pay their NRC bills.
Was that Calvert Cliffs?
No. This is Westinghouse for the AP1000.
Okay. I'm sorry. I was getting wild guess.
Yeah.
I think you have a point about the Reagan fees, but I think the subsidies that Dr. Moore talks about are a huge hugely underutilized tool. You know, right now, the clean coal people want subsidies. Capture and store, they want more research into that. Everyone in Iowa wants ethanol subsidies, even though we wouldn't have anything to eat.
Which are absurd.
Who, me?
No, ethanol subsidies are absurd.
Oh, they are. It's well, you can't make enough. You couldn't make enough fuel. You couldn't. It's just not possible.
If you
the Brazilians have done it.
Well, the Brazilians have done something
different. Sugar.
Well, you know, people point to the Brazilian ethanol industry as more energy efficient than our corn ethanol industry. But the big reason that Brazilian sugar cane is more efficient at producing ethanol and burns less fossil fuels doing it is that they use slave labor to cut the sugar cane and carry it on their backs to the processing facility.
Interesting. I did not know that.
They also wipe out rainforests for the fertile soil
that I didn't know about.
It doesn't need to be fertilized for a few years.
That I was aware of. I was not aware of the slave labor aspect. I think you make a lot of really good points, but I still am what I'm skeptical on, and what I want to ask, flat out. You mentioned these trusts, these individual contributions, but you said it's not a conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we, and of course you yourself said, most of our oil consumption in the U.S. is not for power.
It isn't anymore. True.
It isn't anymore. It's for gasoline.
Right. But in the 1970, and all the way up through 1975, as much as 20% of our electrical power came from burning oil. And that oil that was being burned for power was a very lucrative market for the oil industry. They lost that market. They lost it to nuclear power.
Well, and that being said...
And right now, most major oil companies are not just oil companies. They're oil and gas companies because the stuff comes out of the same well.
Right.
Now, from 1975, or actually from 1990 to 1992 or 93, the only major electrical power plants that were built in the United States were all designed to be powered by natural gas. Some of them could be co-fired with oil.
Right.
Okay.
So those
gas plants are a very lucrative market for the oil industry. Natural gas in 1995 sold for $1.60 per million BTUs. Right now it sells for $10 per million BTUs.
Right.
Partially because we're burning it for electricity.
Right, and that being said, I know there was also a brief movement to sell more cars running on liquid petroleum, natural gas. I know when I was in California, I drove past a few pumps that were, of course, almost like covered in cobwebs.
Right. Well, you also live in Washington, and we've got a whole ton of buses that say powered by clean natural gas.
Not really clean, but
I know, but that's what they say on the bus, right?
Right.
You see those marketing advertisements.
Right. It's good branding, but it's not true.
Agreed.
This is the heart of what I once talked to Dr. Moore about, and we've sort of been beating around it by talking about who it came from.
And who it keeps coming from.
Yeah, and who it keeps coming from. Although I think he thinks the tide is turning.
True.
And if you look at polls, he's right. That more people are in favor of nuclear energy, and there are 7 plants in the approval process. I'm guessing there will be a lot more. You know, I'm guessing there'll be another building going up on Rockville Pike eventually.
Right.
Don't know if that's a good thing.
But you and I both live near Washington, and there's lots and lots of nonprofit organizations in this area. I have sat down with policy people at least three different nonprofits. There's a Climate Action Maryland. There's a bunch. I can't remember the others. And asked them why they will not even consider coming out in favor of nuclear power as a tool in the toolbox against global climate change. And all of them have told me
terrorism.
All of them have told me they will not change their policy because it would be it's against their charters.
Well, it is a central dogma of much of the environmental movement. No nukes. And what happened was, we got into the who, and not as much as the how, but there was a link between the bad, the stuff that blows up, and the stuff that generates electricity. And people made that link in their heads, and to some extent it's still there, and that tide is turning. But here's my question to you, and this is nothing to do with nuclear energy, but say I'm an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I invent something. You know, I invent a car that's powered by water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I invent it, and I want to sell it.
Right.
But, you know, and I have early adopters and becomes popular among, you know, the hipsters and the rich people out in California and whatever. And then there's news reports of these cars, I don't know, blowing up or bad things happening. Inexplicable, random, you know, bad things happening. I like to compare it to what happened to the MySpace website in 2005, 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I like to make that comparison. And you had said something about, you know, new media always being attacked by old media. In some ways that's true, but on the other hand, they're owned by News Corporation now. It's more sensationalism. If it bleeds, it leads. You know, the story of this new water-powered car, you know, killing, you know, a couple of them being in accidents and killing three, you know, killing a bunch of children, it leads a lot better than something than anything else on your evening news, and it picks up traction, and suddenly there's a whole public relations effort against it.
Mm-hmm.
Having seen what happened in the 1970s, and I asked Dr. Moore's question from his side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and his answer was, you got entrepreneurs, got to band together. But having seen what happened to nuclear power, having worked with nuclear power, and now being an advocate for nuclear power, having been one the whole time, I assume. You know, I don't think you would have wanted to serve on a diesel boat.
Absolutely
not. Those things were slow, huh?
And very vulnerable.
Noisy.
No, vulnerable. See, a nuclear boat can't be depth charged.
Interesting. I did not know that.
By the time the depth charge sinks to your level, you can be gone.
You're out of there.
Yep.
Well, that being said. You know, and knowing what you do about nuclear technology, and knowing how, you know, let's get away from the who. Let's get to the how.
Right. Well, see, I am an entrepreneur, by the way. I think that you did mention.
Yeah.
That. Okay. I've been working at this since 1991. Okay. Which
right.
is why I have spent time on the who, because as a tactician and as a strategic thinker who has actually studied that for other purposes, you have to figure out who your enemy really is. You cannot go simply on the people who stand up and say, I'm your enemy. You have to find out who they really are, and you have to figure out what wets their whistle and how to bring them over to your side, if possible.
Now, here's a different question. Here's a different tack on that. If you could sort of step outside time, back up and step back, how would you get out ahead of critics of your technology, whether it's the water-powered car or the nuclear power plant? How do you diffuse the PR bombs? How do you keep what happened to the nuclear power industry from happening to a new media company or a new kind of computer or a new kind of vehicle? How do you, as someone who is an entrepreneur in an industry that's really gotten a bum rap, what advice do you have? And we can come on my show and talk about this more too, because I think that this is something that you would have really brilliant insights into. How do you get out ahead of that bad PR train, and how do you stop it?
Well, interestingly enough, I spent a lot of time thinking about this, and there are good examples of how you get ahead, not how you necessarily avoid the anti and the battles against your technology, but how you build your technology from the ground up so you have enough people on your side that when the inevitable backlash occurs, it doesn't stop you. The nuclear industry set themselves up for failure by going too big too early. And I'm talking about the enormous plants that Westinghouse and General Electric moved very rapidly to building plants whose only purpose could be central station electric power plants. And they became very big targets. And there was no real entrepreneurial wealth created by the technology. Now, in personal computers, and I brought up the personal computer history to you because I've studied that very detailed. Apple and Commodore and a few others were building a cottage industry well before the IBMs ever even recognized that it was worthwhile. Matter of fact, in the early stages, in the late 1970s, when I was in college, and late in high school and in college, there were lots and lots of people that talked about the personal computer as a toy. It would never be in big. It would never, be in business because it was just a toy. It could play games or whatever. And there was a lot of that being spread, but the personal computer industry built a whole bunch of people who couldn't do without those computers. And then they recognized the value of things like spreadsheets and a few other things, and people said, and they built so many that by the time people started going back and complaining about viruses or complaining about this or that, there was enough people that said, we've got to work our way through these problems. We can't just stop. These are things that we're going to do. These days people, we get reports that cellular telephones are going to cause brain cancer. They've been around for a while. But that doesn't stop people from using their cellular telephones because they've recognized just how valuable they are.
Build a better, phone.
Yeah. If I was going to, roll back history, I would love after the war was over and we exploded the bombs, I would have loved if we hadn't put the whole technology under a veil of secrecy for 12, 14 years, where even talking about the fact that heat could be generated from nuclear fission was something that could potentially subject it to treason laws. That's one thing I would do. But even once we opened it up, I would have invited other energy consumers rather than just the electric power industry to the table. I would have invited shipping companies and said, hey, you know, we're thinking about building Navy ships. Would you like to maybe help us in the development costs and think about how these could help you in your shipping business? I would have brought
Soviet
the railroads.
So,
well, we tried. We did one little teeny ship called the Savannah in the U.S., and the Germans built a ship called the Otto Hahn, and the Japanese built a test ship called the Mutsu. But other than that, there hasn't been much in the way of commercial development. But I would have kept, I would have allowed tinkerers into the business. Obviously, there is some amount of risk associated with nuclear that people don't, you know, that it scares the heck out of people. But now, today, we know a lot more about the health effects of low-dose radiation, and we know about protecting ourselves from it to the point where, you know, the nuclear industry's got a tremendous safety record, and it's not by accident, and it's not by because we've got superhumans running the thing.
No,
it really is possible to do it.
I think Dr. Moore said that, that there hasn't been an accident in the West that's caused a death, I think, ever. And then I know that since, I believe, what was it, 19, either 53 or 63, there hasn't been an American or Western nuclear submarine that has gone down. The safety record of nuclear power, am I right?
The Scorpion went down in 68. Thresher went down in 63. But neither one of those is attributed to any problem with a nuclear plant.
Right. One was a hatch, one was a torpedo, right?
Well, one was a hatch. One was a leak near a drain pump of a copper-brazed piping. And the other one is still subject to debate.
Right.
Which I do know the answer, but I can't say it. So.
That's okay. I mean, we can two major theories.
Yeah. But
that's either way, the point remains the same. Nuclear power hasn't killed anyone, and it's helped a lot. It's helped a lot of people. It won the Cold War,
right?
And some would say we're in a new one.
Well,
and why can't nuclear energy win this new one?
Well, you know, I think that it can, and I'll tell you, Andrew, I think that we need to talk again. We'll do it for your podcast next time. But I'm looking at my clock here, and I'm showing that this has probably been my longest one so far, about an hour and 12 minutes. So,
no problem.
I think it's about time to wrap it up. I'm very glad that you agreed to come on, and I hope you understand that I took no offense at your potentially or suggestion that I might possibly be a crackpot, because my ideas are not mainstream. But then again, whose ideas really are? And if you're doing mainstream, then maybe you're just following the crowd. So the idea of technology and policy and their intersection is an important one, and I think that all of us who recognize that technology doesn't invent itself and that public policies do make a big difference on the success or failure of technologies need to talk and work together and try to help policymakers understand how they can do good rather than simply avoiding doing evil. So.
Absolutely, and I'll let you close with that. It's been a pleasure. You guys can check my site at capitalvalley.net, and I thank you for having me. Take us out.
Yeah, and you have any other activities or things that you want to mention at this point? Any other
suggested reading? Right now, I just finished The Future of the Internet and How We Can Stop It by Jonathan Zittrain from Oxford University. And I'll make it quick. He's a professor over there, and he's one of the founders of the Berkman Center at Harvard. And it doesn't have much to do with anything atomic, but he talks about generative systems and established powers and established economies trying to fight off new technologies and what that can lead to. And I think that that's what I just finished reading right now. It's funny how we got this started on a blog discussion and, an offhand comment. I'll be speaking at the Washington DC PodCamp April 18th through 20th. It's at, it's in Arlington, Virginia, and there it is. It's at the Art Institute of Washington, Roslyn Spectrum Theater on Fort Myer Drive in Arlington. And I'm not sure what day I'll be speaking, but I'll be talking about, kind of tongue-in-cheek title, Robot Awareness. Is the title of my talk. It's how to talk about serious subjects without taking yourself too seriously.
Well, that's a good thing, and you got to let me know what time it is, because I can almost make that location without anybody noticing I'm gone from my office.
Fair enough. Well, I work
in Crystal City, so.
Well, there you go. All right. Well, why don't we stay in touch, and I'll let you next time I'm running a podcast, and let's continue the conversation.
All right. Take care, Andrew.
You too. Bye now.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need. Something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.